Don't know how I got in this habit, right? Morning, everybody. My name's Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. I had to laugh. Bob says, oh, I apologize. I used your last name. And my God, with the internet now, if you've ever given a talk, your name's all over the planet anyhow. So I'm not the least bit concerned about anybody knowing my last name. Matter of fact, I could never understand that when I first came around the rooms. You all never gave me your last name. How could I get a hold of you? Right? And then, of course, heaven forbid somebody ever found my address book because there's no last names in it. I don't know about you. I've known people for years in AA, and they'll go, what's their last name? I'll go, I don't know. Right? The power of God showed up in my life and separated me from alcohol the morning of October 19th in 1982. And that power has kept me separated from taking a drink since that time. And I'm very clear on that. And I'm glad I'm very clear in that. Because knowing that allows me to continue to work on a daily basis with the strict spiritual disciplines of steps 10 and 11, which is what I want to talk to you all a lot about, my experience with that, which keeps me reworking steps 1 through 9 on a yearly basis so that I can face and be rid of that which has me blocked from that which is closer than breathing, but which I, if I'm blocked from, feel like I'm a long way from and feel separated from. So I'm going to talk about all that stuff with you. My home group is called Carry This Message Group in Austin, Texas. Me and some pals of mine several months ago copped a couple of resentments, so we did the typical alcoholic thing. We rented a space and got some coffee and started our own meeting. And there were several things that we wanted to do. We have a timer in our meeting. We start with 3 minutes of meditation. It's an open meeting. I finally got even with all these drug addicts. What we did is we rented a room from Cocaine Anonymous in Austin, Texas. So we have an open AA meeting right in the heart of CA in Austin, Texas. So paybacks, you know, but because I believe in singleness of purpose. I have a lot of experience with outside issues, both in my body and out of my body. And many of you know the man who carried the message to me, Don Pritz. I use his last name because he passed away, and he was a world trustee of AA, and he was real clear with me about the traditions and the singleness of purpose. So to this day, I always adhere to that. Whenever I ask to give a talk in AA or I'm in an AA meeting, there's no anda. I mean, the truth, my experience is if I use the andas, you wouldn't hear much of a talk. There'd be too many behind it, but... So we start with 3 minutes of meditation, and then we have a chairperson, and we have a timer. And including the chairperson, you don't talk for more than 5 minutes. And there's another little rule we put in there. When the timer goes off, we would like you to suspend your sentence, right? And what that's about is discipline. It's about submitting to a way other than our own. And also, I was raised on smaller meetings, and I don't know up here, but the meetings, sometimes they go to a meeting in Texas, there'll be 90 people in there. And so at any rate, it's meets every Monday night at 6 o'clock if you're ever in Austin, Texas. I'd love to have you swing by. I stay immersed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things I see, you know, when Don passed away and another teacher of mine, Big Frank, my good friend Joe Hawk, who passed away this year. One of the things I see that people who have long-term sobriety have in common is they stay immersed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have home groups and they have sponsors and they seem to continue to work and rework the steps. And, you know, I go to meetings sometimes. I went back to Indianapolis about 6 months ago and I was asked to speak and they did a countdown and probably 400 people there and there were only 3 people there that have more time than me and I don't think I'm sober that long. And I often ask myself, why is that? Why isn't there more long-term sobriety? We had a book that was published in 1939 that says that if you'll do this, you can recover from a hopeless state of mind and body and get power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction in your life. Why is that? And I think it's because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And what happens is the very gift that was given to me that allowed me to begin to live my life with some dignity and power, I begin to take for granted in a very subtle way. I can slowly drift away over the years. I don't know if there's such a thing as reincarnation, but if there is, I don't think I was a very good man in the last one because The reason I say that, for penance, I get to work with chronic relapsers all the time. And if any of you have ever worked with chronic relapsers, their four favorite words are "I know" and "yes, but." And they know more about the book, and they, "I know, and I know, and I know." And I say, "Excuse me a minute. You got 1 week sober. You know, how well is that working for you? What is what you know working for you?" See, at the end of the day, if what I know doesn't work for me, what good does it do me, right? But anyhow, it's been a journey. I have fond feelings for being up here. I lived in Seattle, Washington in the 70s for about 2.5 years. And the good news about it, it was the beginning of the end for me. And I feel real fortunate. My good friend John, or my pal, I don't use the word friend anymore, and I'll talk to you about that a little bit later. I've had to write way too much inventory on friends. I've never had to write inventory on a pal. You see what I mean? As soon as I use the word friend, I just created a script for you of how you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to act and how you're supposed to treat me. And, of course, you don't do that, so your name goes in column one. And then I write my inventory, and then I read it, and then I do 6 and 7, and then I got to go make amends to you. And I got tired of doing that. One day I realized there's this word pal, right? And I realized that my mind, my ego, does not manufacture a script for pals. I've never had to write inventory on a pal. So John is the oldest guy that I drank and did outside issues with that's still alive. And so he and I go back a long ways, and he's one of my closest pals, you know. So it's and he's in the program again. He's been around it, but now he's in it. I told him he was giving me some static before I came up to speak, and I said, "You know, that's not a really good idea." He said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Giving me a hard time before I come up to speak, because who knows what I may say on tape." But it's good to be here. A lot of fine memories. When I landed, it's funny. I'll tell you about amends up here. Bellevue, Washington, I was 5 years sober. Some of you can relate to this. I used to get resentful when I would read the early stories in the book, because they'd make all their amends in about a day because they never left the town that they drank in. Well, I lived in 7 states. And I had to go, you know, it took a long time to get through all my amends, because you've got to set aside time and you got to fly in. But I was 5 years sober when I came back to Seattle, and in one day in Bellevue, Washington, I sat across from 2 ex-wives and 2 fiancés and made amends to them. What a day that was. But I left a lot of wreckage in the state of Washington, but I had to go to Alaska and make amends there, and I had to go to Oregon, and I had to go to California, and I had to go back to Iowa, and I had to go to South Dakota. And it took me 17 years to make the last amends off my first real inventory. I had 127 names and institutions on there. It took me 14 years to pay back the Internal Revenue Service. I tell people, the most intimate relationship in my life I've ever had is with the Internal Revenue Service. But thank God, you know, for this program. I love life, and I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it has given me. And it allows me to go through life and stay sober and to do things with some sense of integrity with it. And almost everything I learned, at the end of the day, I learned in these rooms. I learned it from men like Don and from Joe and Big Frank and a host of others, you know, along the way. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on what it was like, but I'm a lot more interested in talking to you about my journey when I came into the rooms of AA. And by the way, I did not bring myself to AA. I was brought by this power. I mean, what alky, I love it when they go, "Well, I walked into the rooms on this day." Like, we got up that morning and said, "You know, drinking is a little problematic. And I heard they have a solution to AA. I think I'll go to a meeting." Don't think so. You know, if you're like me and you really are awake and you really look, you'll see a whole series of events happened, and you were brought by great love through this my Creator. I was brought into the rooms to you so you would give me a chance at life again if I wanted to do that. Because the other thing I've learned about my Creator over the years is there's this idea that God's greatest gift to me was free will. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know about you guys. This is the kind of guy I am. Your opinion on an experience you've never had is of no interest to me. For example, I've had many men of the cloth tell me what's going to happen to me when I die. And I love to ask them, do you have any experience with that? And they go, no. And I said, well, I'm not interested in your opinion. And I'm really the same way with everything. But the longer I was sober, I began to realize that if, in fact, God's greatest gift to me is free will, and if my will is such that I don't want to seek and have a close, intimate, loving, active life experience with God, even though God's closer than my breath, I won't experience God. And if I come into the rooms of AA and I don't want to do the work meaning the steps, and go to meetings and get a home broken off to sponsor other people, God won't interfere with that. That's my experience. By the same token, I've learned over the years that if I begin a course of action to let my Creator know that I really want to know my Creator will let me experience my Creator. You know, I don't pretend to comprehend God at all, nor do I understand God. I can tell you that I experience God all the time. There's not a time that I am not experiencing conscious contact with that which created me. I always get a little gun-shy about people that talk to me that understand God. I mean, here's a prime example. Just look around the room. How could any of us understand at one point in time this collection of people at this time in the morning have never been together before and will never be again? How do you understand something that will put that together, right? Or, for example, I'll just take the human body. The Smithsonian Institute, just on one cell in my body, there are 6 volumes that stand almost 5 feet tall telling me about this one little cell in my body. How are you supposed to understand that? Right? I don't have to understand it. I just get to experience. And one of the things about a guy like me is I'm glad that I can't even begin to grasp about this thing called God. I just get to experience because that way it stays always out of my reach. And I don't know about you, but I'm the kind of guy, I burn everything up. Well, you can't burn up God because there's no end to what God is about. That's one of the things I'm going to talk to you about, why I rework the first 9 steps on a yearly basis. Because the noose around my neck this year is what I think I know about God and the steps from the work I did last year. So I resubmit for what? A new experience. Is there more past here? Past this block of belief systems I have about AA, about myself, about you, about the steps. Are there dimensions of joy, wonder, love, power I know nothing about, effectiveness? Oh my God, yes. Yes, am I willing to submit to that? Cast everything I think I know aside. Yes, I am. See? Why do I do that? It keeps it fresh. My life is vibrant. It's alive. My only resentment is there's not enough hours in the day to enjoy this incredible thing called life I get to experience within every breath, free of this insane drama I lived in most of my life, consumed with Mark and what Mark wants and what Mark needs and yada, yada, yada. You know, well, the only time I probably struggle with myself anymore is when I fall asleep for a while and think Mark's all there is. See, because Mark gets afraid. This world's too big for Mark. I was talking about this the other day with a pal of mine. I don't know any of you seen that movie Sling Blade. And at the end of that movie, he's back in the nut house again. He's staring out a window. This guy's talking to him, and he said, well, how was it out there? He looks out there for a while, and he goes, it's too big. See, I get that. See, it's too big. You know, I don't know how I did what I did today, and you all in the world want me to do it tomorrow. See, I got that. I mean, I remember being 15 years sober, and I'm going to go to the grocery store, and I get to the grocery store, and I'm paralyzed with fear, and I can't even walk in the grocery store. Now, at that time, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, what is wrong with me, right? So I was in my 50s, 15 years sober. And then it really hit me. You are ill-equipped to live in this world without the power of God in your life. So I said a prayer. Because, see, I don't know how your mind works. Mine goes like this sometimes. If I'm in a lot of fear and I feel separate from, going into a grocery store is a big deal. Someone's going to look at me. They're going to expect me probably to say hi. You got to walk down the aisle in a grocery store. You can't have your eyes down. You run into somebody. So that means you got to do eye contact. Then humans want something off eye contact. See, that's the, I saw the truth about myself. So I said a prayer, got in touch with power, went in the grocery store and had a great time. See, but I don't kid myself about Mark and how and who and what this whole thing is about. See, this is why I do the disciplines of steps 10 and 11 on a daily basis. Because I'm real clear, when I put the hand on my door and I go to walk out, the game is on. And the game is too big for me, and it scares me, and you scare me. And what I do for a living scares me, etc., etc. So I got to stay hooked up with this power. I got to ride this power all day long. And then at night, I got to do an evening review, do a meditation, and go to sleep still hooked up to the power, and then wake up to the power again in the morning. Because if I don't do that, I experience a thing called untreated alcoholism. I get diseased. And when I get diseased long enough and I'm not in fit spiritual condition, I have a mind that says, we got a little solution for that. It's called alcohol. You know? You all know the voice of alcohol and sobriety. You got some stuff going on, right? And maybe you're off your game. Maybe you haven't done any written inventory for a while. Maybe you got unfinished amends. Maybe you're not doing anything with 10 and 11. Maybe you got consumed with the material world, right? And some stuff happens, because stuff happens as you, if you live long enough, right? And so you got all this turmoil and this angst going on. This little voice starts to say, Mark, I'm here for you, buddy. I never let you down. You know that. Anytime you felt like this, Mark. And by the way, they never had Corona when you and I were out there. And they got lots of new kinds of vodka out there, Mark. I'm here for you, buddy. I'm not like those women. I never let you down. Jesus, you start to listen to that. I'm tingling right now. See, I don't kid myself. I served alcohol for 20 years. You know, and you can't serve two masters. The speaker talked about that last night. And I'm so clear on me and that relationship with alcohol. I loved alcohol more than anything in my life. And I better be the same way with God. You can't be a mad dog for alcohol and come into AA and be a weenie. Right? See, I had to go after God in the steps the same way I went after alcohol. And by God, I did it. I was ripping and roaring and up and down the roads. And nothing got between me and my drink. No job, no woman, nothing. No friends, no family imploring me to please stop. Right? None of that got between me and alcohol. And I have to be the same way in recovery. For me. I was born and raised back in the Midwest in the state of Iowa. Second oldest of four boys. My dad died of alcoholism in 1986. It said his aorta burst, but he died of alcoholism. Got three brothers. As far as I know, two of them are bad alkies. One of them I thought was, but he woke up one day and he'd had a little minor stroke. Caught his attention and, hell, he quit drinking and smoking the same day. Never looked back an inch. So I guess he was fit what you call a hard drinker. I didn't take my first drink of alcohol until I was 16, but I needed to have taken it a lot sooner than that. I don't know what it was about me. The parts of my child I remember, some are good, I suppose some were bad if you were caught up in duality and using those words, but by the time I took a drink of alcohol, everything on page 52 really described me. I was full of fear all the time. I was a prey to misery and depression. Having trouble in personal relationships. List went on and on, and I took a drink, and drinking treats that. I spent a lot of time since I've been sober taking a look at the effect produced by alcohol. And if alcohol did for you what it did for me, that's why it became my God. Because it could do things for me that nothing else could do, and it allowed me to operate in a world that was too big for me. And right from the get-go, alcohol impacted my life. I was involved in all kinds of things in high school, and I took a drink the summer before I was going to be a senior, and I was involved in none of that the next year. And then I went on, and I went to college, and drinking interfered a little bit with that plan, so I kept switching majors. Then there was this little event going on back then called Vietnam. And of course, you know how it is as we get into our delusion behind our drinking is, I just kind of thought they'd forget about me. Well, they didn't. They drafted me. And sent me to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And then I went through AIT training. And then they gave me a two-week leave before I went to Vietnam. And I went AWOL 44 days because I took a drink and the drink took me. And that's how it was, see. I like this. Sometimes I hear in the rooms of people, they have some idea what's going to happen if they relapse. Well, if you drank like I drink, here's what it looks like for me. Is I take the drink and a drink takes me. My last drunk lasts a year and a half. I don't have the power to decide when alcohol is going to let go of me. So I spent 13 and a half months over there, came back, finished up school, got married and rode off to California with my new wife and $150 and lived in California for about a year. By the way, I was going to mention, October is an interesting month for me. I celebrate three birthdays. My belly button birthday is October 14th, 1946. And my sobriety birthday is October 19th, 1982. And there's another date I celebrate. I've been married and divorced four times. Now, not by choice. Big Book says Mark's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. No sane man would be married and divorced four times. So I want to be clear with you, I wasn't choosing that. So there's another date that I celebrate. I haven't found it necessary to get married since October the 21st of 1995. These steps work to treat a lot of stuff. I do a thing I call theater of the lie, you know, in which your mind, ego, your mind creates these. Big Book uses the term stage characters that you and I think define who and what we are. You all have experience with them. In the first 5 minutes you were up this morning, you sat down at the table, and you know these voices that you hear in your head that you started hearing first thing this morning when your eyes popped open? How many of you think there's just one voice there? There's not one voice. There's the different characters. I'll give you an example. My voice is this morning. Pretend there's a table here, right? I drink coffee and I still smoke. So I got a caffeine nicotine addict, and they were the first voices. Get the caffeine, get the coffee going, get it going, right? Have a cigarette, have a cigarette. Now I got this spiritual guy that knows he needs to do the disciplines of 10 and 11, so he chimed in. Yeah, but don't forget, we got to do prayer and meditation. Now I got a jock in me that likes to work out. I haven't been working out since I came up here one time, and he goes, oh, I suppose we're not going to work out today. Right? Now, I got the businessman. He's been gone since Wednesday, so he thinks the business is going to go kaput, and he'll be eating out of a dumpster, and he's going, what time are you going to get in the plane so you can begin to write what's going on next week, right? And then I got my pal John, so I got another stage character called the pal, you know. Well, I wonder how John's going to do when I leave. And all this happened, I ain't even been up 60 seconds. And the reason you're all laughing, you all had the same shit going on. You know, every time you write inventory, trust me, it's one of your stage characters that was hurt, threatened, or interfered with that you're writing the inventory from, right? Here's the problem with having, if you don't wake up to all this, here's the problem. Some of these characters get in conflict because they have different needs, wants, and values. Now, I'll give you an example. If you're a man, you have a stage character, and you're called the stud. Well, when I was married, the married man and the stud have different agendas. Do you get that? See? They get in conflict with each other. Stud has one objective. He wants to get laid, period. Husband doesn't. He made a commitment. He has vows, right? Trust me, the husband has never cheated on the wife. The stud will do it in the drop of a hat. You got the same thing going on. You come into AA, you got this spiritual guy, this AA guy. Some of you, and again, since I'm a man, I'll talk from that perspective. Then you got this business dude that's really got to get to making money to make up for all the wreckage, right? Well, they get in conflict, right? AA guy says, well, we got to go to a meeting, got to call the sponsor, got to work step. And the businessman says, no, you don't. You got to work 12 hours a day and repair this wreckage, for God's sakes. But until I woke up to all this, I was conflicted all the time, right? Just walking. But that's the kind of mind your speaker has. That when I first started to meditate, it felt violent to me. And the reason it felt violent, I had no idea this dialogue was going on. And I'm sitting there with the timer, and the voice goes, and I'm going, whoa! No wonder I drank, right? See, alkies, we're funny people. I think one of the reasons we have to keep coming back to something over and over again, we'll go to a meeting, but we're lucky if we're in the meeting 5 minutes, because the rest of the time we're listening to this chatter. And we walk out of the meeting, how was the meeting? Well, I don't know. You know, sponsor's got to repeat something to you 92 times, right? I've learned this over the years. When I work with the men I sponsor, I set a timer for 60 minutes. And that's probably 50 minutes too long. But I figure in 60 minutes they'll be with me about 5 or 10 minutes of it. Then they're, because you look over, right? You know what that's like. You're sitting there talking to an elk and you look over. They're just blank. Hey! Oh! the mind, you know. And unfortunately, if your mind's like mine, not only is it a lot of dribble, it's normally about the past, which is no more than just an old movie. The future is not here, and it's very repetitive. Just, you know, a meditation. Thank God for meditation. It finally freed me from realizing that I was my mind. But, you know, I drank for a lot of reasons. Quite frankly, one of them was just to try and get it down to one voice, you know, at a time. But I lived in California for a year and then moved up to Oregon 2 years. In Oregon, 2 years up here, up to Alaska, and my drinking began to assume more serious proportions, coupled with some outside issue stuff. But drinking was at the heart of my whole deal. Anything I did that's outside issues was always just designed so I could drink more. And there's really one incident that really describes my alcoholism and this mental obsession and why I was doomed to die an alcoholic death. I had relocated to Denver, Colorado, and I got involved in a business franchise with those outside issues. And I'd been up for 5 days. And I had been drinking and doing a few other things that let you stay up for 5 days. And I went into respiratory failure, and my heart stopped. And thank God I was living with a woman who was a paramedic. And she actually saved my life. They put me on a flight for life. Boy, that's a trip. Any of you not done drinking? If you want to have an experience sometimes, they stick you in that helicopter and you're out on the wing. You know, and I've been up 5 days. I've been busy. And it's like 8 o'clock at night, and I'm up in the mountains in Colorado, and they're medevacking me down to a hospital in Inglewood, Colorado, and I'm out on the wing, literally strapped into it's not like you're inside there, and it's going, whoa. And they land the helicopter, and I'm in intensive care, and I'm in that hospital for 5 days. A pal of mine shows up, and I leave the hospital with him, and he said, what do you want to do? I said, I need a drink. And we went to a bar, and I was drunk that night and doing outside issues again, 5 days after I died. And that really sums up me and my relationship with alcohol and where it took me. And just like the big book said, I was a tornado. And I never kid myself about that. If you were in my life for very long, I assure you I inflicted harm in one way or another on you. And I think a couple of our speakers have alluded to, in the process of amends, the biggest harm I ever did to people who cared about me is I robbed them day after day, month after month, and year after year of their emotional security. It isn't the money, it isn't any of that stuff. It's robbing them of their emotional security. And I tell the men that I sponsor, it's not okay. You're sober. It is not okay that you do that one more second. If you tell your family member or loved ones you're going to be there, you're going to be there. See, we've stolen all we need to steal from people. I don't think we have the luxury sober to continue that form of behavior with any sense of inward peace within ourselves. From Alaska, I went back to Colorado. Many of my last 3 to 4 years of drinking, a lot of it was a haze. Toward the very end, I met a gal in a bar on a Friday night. I wound up getting an altercation, beating the shit out of the guy she was with, and within a week I was living with her, and in 2 weeks I married her. I needed a place to sleep. I didn't have one. And the beginning of the end for me really happened. She thought I had a problem with alcohol, and so there was this big church in Denver, Church of the Nazarene, and they were doing one of these big evangelical movements. And they sent out one of the ministers from that church, and this guy 12-stepped me with a Bible. The reason I know that, I stole his Bible from him. And I did make amends, and I still have it. He said I could have it. So much like Bill Wilson, I thought that my drinking could outlast his preaching. But then they did a weird thing. They thought it would be helpful if I would go to the revival meeting they were having that night. And so at that time, I'm deep in the cups, and sure, you know, you're pretty much immune to everything. And so get in the car and I go there. This church was mammoth. They could hold like 2,000, 2,500 people. And you all can relate to this too, probably, is this dialogue you have in your mind that has no sense of reality. I'm walking in this church, and by then I drank up every friend in the world. There weren't any left, and the family wasn't having anything to do with me, and this voice is saying, what if somebody sees you? Wasn't anybody I was running with going to be in that place? So then we sit down, and they do what they do, and you can all relate to this too, as people around you, they're doing stuff, but you're into your internal dialogue, your neat little world. And they do this altar call. And then some of you, if you drank like I did, probably have this experience where your body does things that you had no say in. And the next thing I know, my body's standing up when they're doing this altar call, and the voice I'm saying to myself, my God, what are you doing? You know, and I'm getting this possession going down to be saved. And I'm screaming inside, sit down, sit down, sit down. Body's just, you know. So I get down there, and there's like 6, 8, 10 of them, the tambourines, and they're slapping heads and doing all that, you know, you take Jesus, yes, yes! You know, I got all caught up in the moment and threw myself on them, and you know, they're doing all that stuff, and they get this, they had a little book, and you know, see, now they tricked me. See, because they got their own third step, you know, and they made me sign this little book. On this was September the 28th of 1982. So on this book I write in there, I give my life to Jesus, do, and I sign my name, right? Hell, I don't think anything of that stuff. Well, I should have known in this mystical world, I just told the Creator I wanted some help, didn't I? I didn't know that. So I leave there, make a long story short, I wound up admitting myself to a detox the morning of October 19th, 1982. And that particular morning, this power showed up and literally stripped the obsession to drink from me, and it has never returned from that moment to this day. And I didn't have anything to do with that other than that particular night, I said to this Creator, I want your help, right? And the Creator responded. Of course, being the typical alcoholic, I had no recall of any of these events, nor did I see any of the connections. And I was in that place about 30, 40 days. I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage. Everything I owned fit in a duffel bag. And that's where King Alcohol took me, because I did serve that master as long as it seemed necessary for me to serve it. Sometimes when I look at my experience as to what happened to me, it kind of goes like this. It's like my Creator said, you got work to do, and you are so idiotic, you will never get this. And like, bam! You know, I'm gonna separate you from alcohol. And so I started going to meetings and got a home group and did some step work, but I was really, really in horrible shape from just all the years. And finally, somewhere around 3 years, things got better. I got a good job. That lady and I bought a house and mountain property, and I did that alcoholic thing where inside my self-esteem is absolutely in the toilet. I'm fear-based all the time, and I have this belief system that if I accumulate enough outward stuff, somehow that will treat that condition. See, I spent way too much of my life trying to go out here to bring something to somehow make me feel okay, not realizing that will never happen. That okayness is an inside-out proposition, which is really what AA does, the steps do. So here I am at three and a half years sober, and I know I'm heading toward a drink. And the truth was, I'd done very little step work whatsoever. Now, some of you know my pal Joe Hawk. He had hooked up with Don Pritz and started working the steps, and I knew he was on a different footing. So I got a hold of Don, and I said, I'd like to talk with you. So we sat down for a little bit, and you would think after being around AA that time and the big book and going to big book studies, I would have had a clue about the first step. But the truth was, I didn't have a clue about the first step. I didn't know why I was an alcoholic. And because he asked me that question, he said, why do you think you're an alkie? So I started telling him about, well, the flight for life. And he said, well, I'm an alcoholic. I never had that happen to me. And that first meeting with him, every reason I gave him why I thought I was an alcoholic, he hadn't done, and he was an alcoholic. Finally, he looked at me, he said, I don't think you have a clue what the first step's about. And I said, well, I think that's a possibility. You're right. And he said, well, here's the deal. He said, you have absolutely nothing I want. He said, I have a busy life. If you want to have this experience, you and I are going to start in the title page. And he said, we will meet at my house at 6:30 in the morning. And he said, we'll do that every Tuesday morning. We're going to do the work for about an hour. This is going to be real simple. Whenever the book gives you instruction, you're going to follow that instruction. Are you willing to do that? And I said, yes. Now, he said, here's some other things you need to know. He said, at the end of the day, this program is about you and a relationship with God as you have understand God. It's not about any kind of dependence on me. He said, I've got a wife, I've got children, I've got a job. You will not be calling me 2-3 times a day. He said, I go to bed between 9:30 and 10 at night. If you get thirsty beyond 10 o'clock, go down to the 24-hour club. He said, my job is to get you independent of me as quick as possible and in touch with a power greater than yourself. I said, fabulous. So he and I started that journey, and it was a remarkable journey. And then I did the thing I think that happens to a lot of us. Got up to the ninth step, did not complete all my amends, did a little bit with steps 10 and 11, a little bit with sponsorship, and really got caught up in the material world of earning money and doing this and doing that. And that worked so well that between my ninth and tenth year in the program, I wound up in a nut house in Houston, Texas. And I couldn't work. It was a combination of a lot of things. It was severe untreated alcoholism. It was pretty severe PTSD and a few other things. And I've been given signs all along the way to go take care of this. But, of course, I'm into self-well-run riots, so I'm not going to listen to any of it. And in hindsight, when I look back in Bay City, Texas, in a psych hospital full of real wackos, about my second or third week in there is I did the third step prayer, and I had my first profound experience with it of really the words of that prayer. I mean, think about this prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me, and you do with me as you want. Period. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it meant for me at that time. I'd given life my best shot drunk and sober, and I'm sitting in a nut house in Houston, Texas, and I'm broke, and I got no money, and I got no job. And every fiber of my being is full of pain. And I basically said that prayer that day. And I said, you know what, God? I really mean this. I give up. I quit. From this day on, I'm going to do what my big book says to do, and all the rest is in your hands. Where I live, who's in my life, all of that is no longer my business. Because I make it my business, and I wind up in places like this. Because that's not one of the promises of the big book, by the way. Between your ninth and tenth year, you'll get locked up in a nut house, lose everything that you have, and start life over again. That's not in there, right? But remember I told you, my experience is God won't interfere with my self-will. Okay. So I left that nut house, and I wound up getting... then the nut house hired me. So I went back to Texas, packed up everything I knew, and my 78 Saab... And I drove to Texas in 1991 with $100 on my back and a 1978 Saab and a deep understanding about the third step in my life is no longer my business and that I was going to do exactly what my big book said. And I'd gone back in the big book and I saw that I had unwritten inventory and I had unfinished amends. And I saw that I really had been doing very little with the strict disciplines of 10 or 11. Let me tell you what I mean by strict disciplines. You have the same big book I had. It's very clear what I'm supposed to do in the morning. Upon awakening, let me consider my plans for the day. And then there's a whole bunch of prayers, and then it tells me to meditate. The rules are very, very clear in there about what I'm supposed to do. By the way, these are the things I've discovered that keep me in fit spiritual condition. Went to a meeting the other day in Bellevue, and two people used this phraseology I hear in the rooms. You've probably all heard it. Drinking's not an option, right? You ever heard that one? It's inconsistent with my book. If I'm not in fit spiritual condition, my experience is drinking is always an option to treat what's wrong with me. Now, in fit spiritual condition, drinking is not an option because I'm in a position of neutrality. It's not my business anyhow, right? But to a guy like me, and if I'm not in fit spiritual condition, doing the disciplines of 10 or 11, as far as I'm concerned, I'm shooting craps. But I looked and I saw how little I'd been doing with 10-11. I hadn't been doing that every morning. I hadn't done anything with meditation my first 10 years in the program. The book's very clear about meditation. So I begin to say all those prayers and I begin to work with meditation. I begin to get a timer. Started with 5 minutes. That's when I experienced the chatter of 1,000 monkeys. All the voices. Whoa. And then pretty soon 5 minutes became 10, and 10 became 15, and 15 became 20, and I began to see the effect that meditation began to have in my life, and the fear began to leave, and I began to have an intuitive sense of what to do and where to go. And I began to be much more effective as I began to work with these men, and I became more effective in my job. And then again, the strict spiritual disciplines. You know, there's a whole paragraph in there about what I'm supposed to do before I go to bed at night. And there's a whole bunch of questions I'm supposed to answer, and I realize today those questions are about, Mark, were you at all awake during your day? Because you said, and when I do evening review, I start with the last thing I did, and I go back to when I got up, and there's some great questions in there. Mark, were you resentful during the day? Close my eyes. Boom. Yeah, here, here, here. Cut me off in traffic. Boom. Were you dishonest, Mark? Go back through the day. Were you afraid? Yeah, I was afraid here, 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 here. What are these things designed to do? They're designed to wake me up to myself about what's really, really going on with me, right? There's other questions in there about, you know, was I thinking of myself most of the day? I would like to tell you that I've been able to answer no to that. I never have. There's a question in the book. Were you thinking of yourself most of the time? Yes. See, I don't think I'm different than anyone in this room. The only time I've ever done anything without a selfish motive behind it was by mistake. Guy comes up and says, well, would you sponsor me? Now, I'm interested in getting home, watching TV, reading. I don't care. Will you sponsor me? Oh, geez. Then you put on the AA face. Well, I don't know. Let's sit down and talk about that. Act like you really care, you know. But you see what I mean? You aren't any different than me. How can the root of my trouble be selfish, self-centered, and I be this nice guy? Not going to happen. So God places me in positions all the time where I have to take a course of action the exactly opposite of the way I would go. And then I do that and I leave there and I feel incredible. Those of you who do much in the way of sponsorship or 12-step work, particularly sponsorship where you're working one with one out of the big book, if you're like me, I'll work with somebody for an hour or so and they'll leave and I'm on this high. I mean a high. Well, I finally figured out why. I got away from me for an hour. Right? I mean, we were laughing at my pal John. John and Joey and I were sitting there talking. He walks in. We'd been together most of the day talking, fellowship, and he walks in. He sits down. He pauses for a minute, and he goes, God, I wear myself out. And that was so classic, because don't we do that? You know, and when I work with someone else, I'm not wearing myself out. See, I don't exist. I'm there to be of service to them and to help them, which is probably why there's a whole chapter in here. When all else fails, Mark, go do this. Get away from yourself for a while with your needs and your wants and yada, 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 right? So I begin to work with those strict spiritual disciplines. And my God, I begin to watch my life take off in every sense of the word. Wound up living in Kerrville, Texas about 5 years. Then I, Austin, Texas, for me it was more an issue of getting moved. And I had an interesting experience when I was down there. Once I got really clear on the precise, specific, clear-cut instructions, and I started to carry my experience of that message into the rooms, quite often I discovered I was not very popular. Some of you may have that experience. And do you know what? I didn't care. I just didn't care, because at the end of the day, alcoholism kills and kills every time. And I won't ever lie to a drunk. You know, keep coming back, it'll get better. No, it won't. Unless you get some power in your life. It won't get better, right? I mean, think about this, ladies and gentlemen. AA's been around almost 70 years. Membership's going down, not up. Why do you think that is? Because alcoholism is invariably a fatal progressive illness, as exactly as the big book says. And as far as I can tell, if I don't get in touch with this power and maintain a relationship and improve upon that relationship at some point in time, a drink starts to look awful good to me. And or suicide, different things like that. We have a 75% higher rate of suicide than the average American population. Do you know that? You think that's because we're having a good time sober? No, don't think so. I also realized there was something else I wanted to start doing, which was my body can't live off the food I ate 2 weeks ago. And I can't live off an old experience with inventory. And I can't live off an old experience with step work. So once a year, I resubmit to the first 9 steps. I like to write out a prayer, set aside what I think I know for an open mind, a new experience. Bring a beginner's mind to the process, to your meetings, to your relationships, right? And then I normally get some pals of mine, and we sit down and we go through the book again. Take a look at the first step, the phenomenon of craving, doctor's opinion to page 23. Is this you? When you take a drink, Mark, do you lose power, choice, and control over how much? What would happen to you, Mark, if you took a drink? See, and for me, the answer to that is simple, is I don't know. I have a lot of history about what I think will happen. Now I look at pages 23 to 43. Pages that I think are probably the least understood in the book, and those are the pages that show me beyond a shadow of a doubt. I commit the most insane act of my life, stone cold sober. See, Don tricked me. One time he said, I want you to make a list of the 10 most insane things you've ever done. So I make the list, and obviously everything on there was things I did behind the drink, right? He said to me, if this is what you do when you take a drink, the most insane thing you've ever done is not on this list. I said, what are you talking about? He said, the most insane thing you would ever do is to be sober and take a drink again. And I got it. I commit the most insane act of my life, stone cold sober. It's not about having the booze in me. It's being stone cold sober, and my mind convinces me to take a drink. And I see that that is my truth. That there better be something between me and acting on that. And the big book later on tells me, fifth spiritual condition, Mark. You're given a daily reprieve. Bottom of page 43 sums me up every time. Once more, Mark has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Mark's defense must come from a power greater than himself. Then I look at the unmanageability of my life, the stuff on page 52. And when I go back through the steps, ladies and gentlemen, it's current stuff. See, the stuff I'm going to get drunk on today is not old stuff or the unmanageability of my life. It's my current stuff, right? 15 months ago, for example, I started a new business. There's a little stress and fear that comes along with that. You see? That's the current stuff. I had relocated. I'd been in Dallas 6 years. I moved back to Austin, Texas. It's a whole new environment, right? I've got to make new relationships. That creates some angst. Everything is new. Everything that was going on in my life is new. That's why I go back through and take a look at that. Where's that out today, right? How is it, Mark, with all your employees? How is it with your pals in AA? You know, what's your relationship like with yourself, with your physical body, with your finances? How about your mental thought life? How about your emotional state? And I go back in every area of my life and I take a look at it currently. Where am I at with all that? Do you want any of it to change, Mark? You know? You want any of it to change, yeah. This process, I'll tell you what it did for me. Some of you might relate to this, but I was 53 or 54 years old and still experiencing what I call financial insanity. And I did an inventory, and the reason I was... Here's what I mean by financial insanity. I've always earned good money. I had no retirement plan. None. You know why? You know what my inventory showed me? Two things. One, I was going to win the lotto. Some of you laugh, because I'll bet some of you do this. The second was, I obviously thought I was a financial planner. Of course, I'd never had any training in that area. Right? And the third was, I obviously thought I was never going to get old. Now, when you got those belief systems, you don't have to get financially sane. And I looked at that, and I said, this is unacceptable to me. So I found someone who was sober a long time, who was financially sane, and I said, I'm willing to submit my financial life to you. And within 5 years, I paid off $60,000 in debt. I had almost $80,000 in a cash reserve, which was money I had to have in order to start this new business. See, that's why I love going through the steps again. I don't care what area of your life you want to work with, but these steps will address every single one of them. Here's the other thing I didn't realize. Any of you, for example, that can relate a little bit with what I'm calling financial insanity. Till I got to the other side of it, I had no idea of the amount of fear that was being generated because I'm still acting like a child with my finances. Tremendous amounts of fear. It's a wonder I didn't drink over it. But you don't know that till you get outside of it. I remember the last check I wrote to be debt-free. That was one of the most exciting experiences I've had being sober. See, and is this tied into taking a drink again? You bet it's tied into taking a drink again. See, I believe that if I'm going to have this program, the book talks about sane and sound, why shouldn't I experience financial sanity? Why shouldn't I use this power to do that? But remember, my experience is, if I didn't want to be financially sane, God wasn't going to show up at all in that area of my life. If I was going to continue to operate on my current belief systems, right? So I go back through and I look all that. Second step, is God bigger than what I know of God to date, right? Can God take me past here? See, every one of us sitting in this room right here this morning, every area of your life, you have a set of belief systems you currently use in every one of those areas. Is there more past there that you don't know anything about, and can God take you there? Are there dimensions of experiencing God that you know nothing about? Are you willing to go for that? Are you willing to lay aside what you think you know about God? Wow. Right? See, my experience is, to experience God, you must be out of your mind. This was another trap I had. I think because my mind tells me I believe in God, I do. Yet I didn't live my life like I believed in God. You see what I just said? I've helped all kinds of men who came to me with strong belief systems about God that didn't know God at all. And the belief systems were preventing them from having experience with God. See? Something far deeper beyond the mind. And that's what I look at in the second step. Am I willing to believe there's a power greater than myself can take me past here? Yes. Yeah, I am. Book says then, mark your face with a self-imposed crisis, which is what you think you know about yourself, the program, the steps, every area of your life. You're willing to choose God's everything or He's nothing. Again. Yeah, everything. Then that incredible third step decision. Are you willing to meet the requirement? Requirement before the third step again. Am I convinced my life, run on my will, 25 years without a drink, drunk or sober, cannot and will not work? And sit with that. And take a look at your areas of my life, and I try and define areas in which maybe there's a little bit too much self-will going on. I recently got trapped in that with at work. It looked on the outside, if you came in and on the outside, it would have looked like I was really trying to do good things for my employees, most of which are in recovery. But there was, in hindsight, it was all self-will. Why do I say that? Because I didn't go to ask any of my employees and ask them if they'd like to participate in this. I just thought it was a good idea. And of course, as I found out, about 80% didn't want anything to do with it, right? Trying to force my will on them. But I wouldn't have seen that if I hadn't reworked the steps, right? And then I make that third step decision. I say that prayer again, then I launch into inventory. My last time through the work, I had 9 resentments. Good news about doing work with 10 and 11 is you stay current. My inventory is not a big inventory. It shouldn't be inventory. If you're doing evening review every night and you're doing corrective measures and you're any bit awake, you're cleaning up your stuff, the mistakes you create as you go along, right? Some of you can relate to this that maybe have been sober for a little while. Remember I told you a stage character I got's this spiritual guy? He likes to pretend nothing bothers him. Like he's enlightened or something, right? My experience is that is not true. So sometimes I have to use other words. Well, make a list of people who annoy you. Ooh. Do, 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 do. My list of 3 becomes 19. Those are resentments. See? Make a list of people who you're uncomfortable with. Right? So I write a 4-column resentment inventory. Column 1, column 2. You know, for years we lived our life that way. I could live in column 1. Column 1 is your name and column 2 is what you did. And that's as far as I got, and that's what most of my dialogue with you all was about too. Column 1 and 2. I can always tell people don't have much work with inventory because if you talk to them, most of their dialogue is about column 1 and 2. And they know very little about column 3 and column 4. And they certainly don't embrace the concept of all my troubles are my own making. You don't think the big book meant all of our troubles are our own making, do you? Yeah, it did mean that, right? I mean, third column, I got it right, where am I playing God? Every time. Third column for me is not about low self-esteem. It's about a little too much. right? Self-esteem, how I see and feel about myself. You better see where you're playing God in the third column. Everything I write in the second column, in the third column, the only reason I wrote it is I'm sitting in judgment and you, I'm playing God, right? And I see that. Pride, how others see me. Ambition, what I want. And I don't pull any punches with what I want. You know? And security, what do I need to be okay? Sex relations, personal relations, money, pocketbook. I am my money, right? Watch how that gets threatened. And then there's that incredible bridge to the fourth column. And it is. It's a bridge. It's where all the freedom lies. Third column, I start to see where I'm playing God. I start to see where I'm separated. And then it talks about, I begin to look at the idea that perhaps these people in the second column are spiritually sick like me. Okay, we'll entertain that. It could be. And then there's this prayer. God help me from being angry. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. And now we're going to completely disregard them, and now I'm going to look at you. Mark, your troubles are your own making. There's a line in the big book. It took me a long time to understand, but it's my truth. It says, invariably, Mark made a decision based on self. It's later placed Mark in a position to be heard. Here's my experience with that. I have never, ever written a piece of inventory that I didn't set in motion. Ever. Based on selfishness. Sometimes I got to go back 10 years to see it, but I always see it. Here's why that's important to me. One of the greatest statements of hope in the big book is that all my troubles are my own making. Here's why that's important. I take complete responsibility for my life, every phase of my life. And I love that because I can work with that. I got something I can go to there, right? So I finished writing the resentment inventory, fear inventory. Right in the middle of the resentment and the sex inventory, right? Agnosticism. I get to see my current agnosticism. See, if you've been sober for a while and you, quote, have a relationship with God, but you're afraid, if you want to know where your current agnosticism is, look at your current fears. Because God and fear do not exist in the same house. So the current fears I'm up against are areas in which there is no God. So I write the fear inventory. Then I write the sex inventory. Then I do fifth steps. I do multiple fifth steps. I take a body of work and I read it to 2, 3, 4, 5 different people. If you haven't tried it, it's a fabulous experience. Big book says, take your inventory and read it to person or persons. So I do that. It's very, very ego deflating. You get a whole different perspective with it. And I do fifth steps with some elders and I do fifth steps with the men I sponsor. Because I want them to understand there's no arrival place. You don't arrive anywhere. You know, I don't, just because you're a long time sober and love God and you're a good member of AA, that doesn't mean you don't turn into a jerk any given day. Right? I've never met an alky that awake yet. Right? We're just not. I don't think any of us would ever be enlightened. We'd just descend out of here and start another David Koresh compound somewhere. Right? So, my defects and my mistakes keep me centered right in the rooms, keep me right centered right in the work. So I do that, and then step 6 and 7, the exact nature of my defects. And there's a lot of different tools out there for that. And I like to take a look at those and give a name to them and take them to God in the 7th step. And just like the speaker said the other day, I don't have any judgments about what's good or what's bad. I said to my good friend Joe Hawk one day, as far as I can tell, sometimes yourself will run riot as God's will for me. See what I'm saying? Most of you have that experience where somebody has done something to, quote, hurt you, which is normally their self will run riot, correct? And at the end of the day, it's God's will for you because you wound up going through a lot of growth through that experience. See? So I have to let go of what's good and what's bad. So then, of course, out of that, you make a list of amends. And you know, any of you who know Don P very well know that there's a word they really like there that they work with in the 8th step, made a list of all persons being harmed. Ooh. That means all. Pay all the money back. Anything that comes to you over the years, I was thinking the other day when I came up here in 1995 and I did a retreat with a bunch of people. And I was staying at my pal John's place, and I woke up on a Monday morning, and I did a lot of blackout drinking. And there were a lot of things that went on with women I really didn't remember. And I was 12 or 13 years sober then, and I literally pulled out a pad of paper, and all kinds of clear visual images came back about some stuff that I had done, and I made a list of that. And out of that was a whole other body of work, and I was able to find some of those women and make amends, and a bunch of them I wasn't. So I was able to write a whole bunch of letters, and I found an elderly woman in AA, and I read those letters to her as though I was making the amends. And there was a huge shift in my relationship with myself and all women from that day to this. So you see, there's no end to what can happen in this process of submitting to these steps again. And now I'm back up to the disciplines of 10 and 11, but it's clean. I cleaned off the slate again for the times that I fell asleep over the course of the last year, and now I'm back into my morning disciplines. 10-step, incredible tools you use all day long. Things like ask, turn, pause, thy will be done, how may I best serve thee, sixth sense. 10-step talks about, Mark, you have a new sixth sense. You've entered the world of the Spirit. I take my awakened spirit out into the world all day long. Walk into Starbucks, gal's got a frown on her face. Can you get her smiling? Everywhere I go. Give, 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 give. Are you awake? Are you awake to people? Gal coming to clean the room every day, tip, look her in the eye. Thank you. Thank you for making my bed. Thank you so much for cleaning the bathroom. Here, take this. You have a great day today. Look her right in the eye, right? She's serving me, you see? All people like that. You go through life awake like that. What an incredible way. And you give, give, give. The other thing that happened to me, I realized a couple years ago, there's this, I spent most of my life wanting to get love, you know, and I realized a couple years ago I'd never think about that. All I do is give, 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 give. My sense of self is generated from the inside out, not the outside in, right? Some of you may enjoy what you hear today, some of you may not, and I need you to know I'm just fine whether you do or you don't. See, it's for only from this place that I can love. Because who and what happens through me is not predicated anymore on how you respond to it or don't respond to it. And if I do good things for people, I never give one second of thought, is there anything coming back at me? Of course, in the end result, there's more coming back at me than I even know what to do with. Right? I mean, I was the kind of guy when I sobered up, if I died, I would have had to be cremated because I couldn't have found six people to carry the casket. And if I died today, it would take a pretty big room to hold the people that said, you know what, I'm glad you were in my life. And that's what AA has given me. The ability to be a good pal to people. The ability to be a good employee. You know, to let my words and to have some integrity. To be responsible, right? To pay my bills. To show up. Honesty. Say what you do. Do what you say. All of those incredible things have come to me as a result of staying involved in all three parts of this program. Working the steps, doing those inventories, making those amends. Being accountable to men who are like-minded, who are doing the deal like I'm doing the deal. Right? See, I have five people in my life that I've given spiritual consent to. Spiritual consent means I've said to them, if you ever see me straying off, you better be saying something to me. That's the we part of the program. I do still do a thing called steel on steel. I like to read, as reading scripture one day, Proverbs. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for Solomon, it might help me. So I started a thing in 1994 called steel on steel, in which I sit down with the men I work with, and we do steel on steel with each other. We talk about last 7 days, how much I did with prayer and meditation. How many evening reviews did I do? How many meetings did I go to? Where am I in the steps? Where are the men I sponsor in the steps? Where am I at with money, career, my health, honesty, making amends? Where am I at with all those areas? And then once you get done sharing that, then you have to shut up and pull out a notebook and they give you considerations. Well, Mark, I'd like you to consider the fact you're not sponsoring ones because you haven't been going to meetings. And you have to write that down and say thank you. Thank God for that program. It helped me get financially sane. But I have to have that kind of accountability. You know, I learned a long time ago, having one sponsor, I don't know how you guys drink and how you are, but a team works best for me. I do have a financial sponsor. I found a man who was financially sane. He retired when he was 52. And he really understands how money works. So I was willing to submit to his plan. He's still my financial planner today. He's not my financial planner. He's my financial sponsor. Because my experience is I was absolutely wacko when it came to the money issue. Right? But there's four different groups of men that I use. It's literally, I call it my team. And the reason is simple is I put my pride down long enough to see all the areas that I didn't have any experience with and was willing to submit to a way other than my own. And I looked at the quality of my life. Took off like a rocket in all those areas. Work under those daily disciplines. Thank God for those. 12-step. Currently sponsoring five men down in Austin, Texas. They're in various... One of the strongest things I'm doing right now is there's a group of us on Thursday nights. We meet from 5:30 until 7. And I have a feeling it's much like the early days of AA. We go through the book together and we really talk to each other. Very open with each other. We hold each other really accountable. And we share our experiences with each other. And such a powerful experience. There'll be anywhere between 6 and 15 of us there. So I stay immersed in this. I stay involved. Alcoholics Anonymous is as fresh or fresher to me today than it was the day I came in. Because there's no end to what I get to experience with this. With you and with this power. See? And then I get to take this out to be of service to God and my fellow human beings in every area of my life. Thank you all very much. God bless you.